Hey guys, just so you know, we're coming to the close of season 3 of Casually Critical. The episode that's going to be airing next week is going to be our 2023 movie forecast and also our Casually Critical Awards, where we award movies that we've reviewed previously this year. So stay tuned for that and Merry Christmas.
Warning, this narrator advises that the listener digest the following as entertainment. The showrunners behind it are neither six-figure filmmakers nor professional critics. They are Casually Critical.
Hello and welcome to Casually Critical, the podcast show starring two pals who love to check wardrobes for hidden worlds. I'm your host, Daniel Carpenter.
And I'm James Newton, your co-host. Daniel.
What?
We're checking wardrobes?
Well, we are in this episode. We're reviewing 2005's The Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Sorry, that was a lengthy title.
How many nouns can you put in one movie title?
The is what we're reviewing today. Yeah, so we thought this would be our Christmas movie review. This is one of the few movies where we go, hey, this seems like a very appropriate Christmas film. And if you want a more specific definition of what we mean by Christmas film, please watch our more recent Casual Correspondence episode where we dive a little bit more into it. But James, this for me is like cracking open a cold one of nostalgia, because I remember that when I was in homeschool, me and all my homeschool friends, we were reading the Chronicles of Narnia books, and we read all seven, and then this movie adaptation came out, and we went and saw it. It was a late night premiere, which I guess, according to my definition as a little kid, was like 7 or 8 p.m.
Oh, yeah, up past bedtime.
We went and saw it and actually got some goodie bags, which was really fun. But as we walked out of the theater after seeing it, it was starting to snow. And like really hard, not in a blizzard way, but in like big, thick snowflakes. And it was beautiful.
The magic.
It's very kind. Very magical. So all that having been said, this holds a special little place in my heart. But James, do you have any history with this movie?
I do. Yeah. The church that I grew up in rented out the theater to see a premiere of this. The Goodrich Willow Knolls, I think it's number 13. Shout out to the theater of my origin. But our church, we probably were able to get like 100, 150 people to come to this premiere because everyone was on Christmas break and it was close to the holiday and everything. So it was really big and exciting. And I don't remember the viewing experience at that point, but I do remember it being really cool and pretty scary too.
Yeah, this movie is surprising in a number of ways, and the story of which might be familiar to all of you, but there's four children who come across a wardrobe hidden away in an upstairs room, but they discover that this wardrobe is not what it seems, and behind it, within it, is a magical, massive world of Narnia, which is a fictitious fantasy world ruled by a mythical lion named Aslan. And they have to go and fight this evil woman, the White Witch, who has taken over the land and thrown it into perpetual winter. This is a very long movie. This is 2.5 hours long, which I barely remember. It doesn't often feel that way. But I want to say this, James. During the opening sequence, as we're seeing the titles flash, like directed by blah, 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 produced by blah, 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 there were two names that were very familiar to me. That of Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely, who also wrote the script for Infinity War, Endgame, Winter Soldier, and more recently, The Gray Man, which is on Netflix. They're writers that I've begun to deeply appreciate. And I'll be honest with you, I'm starting to get a feel for their style. And they write epics really well. And this movie feels like no exception. The pacing especially is surprisingly brisk. We get thrown into the next scene and I'm like, oh, we just cut out a lot of time. We're not wasting time at all.
I'll tell you another name that I recognize, Daniel, not as the beginning credits were rolling, but as the end credits were rolling. Rhythm and Hues, may it rest in peace,
RIP,
did the visual effects for this. And they're most predominantly known probably for their bankruptcy in working on The Life of Pi.
Yes.
The visual effects in this movie, I want to highlight because they're very strong for 2005. Very,
dude,
very
they
strong.
Have aged. I was shocked at how many visual effects have aged well in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, shocked.
As was I. I miss you, Rhythm and Hues.
I do know that Weta had a hand in at least the props designs and the sets. They were fresh off of the Lord of the Rings trilogy and helped with this. And it's surprising to think about now, but a lot of fantasy shows that are premiering that are adapted, a lot of movies that are coming out that are fantasy that are adapted, a lot of them feel half-hearted. The visual effects aren't quite up to snuff. There's not really a love in the story, not a lot of craft. It's just kind of a, well, you know how it is. There's people, they find a world, they go on an adventure, there's a big battle at the end, blah, blah, blah. But this one is different. For one, the budget is pronounced. It's here. Ladies and gentlemen, there's effort put into it. But I just kept forgetting how amazing the music is, how powerful the soundtrack. Right after Lord of the Rings, the movie trilogy, I think one thing you and I touched on in our review of it a few seasons back is that it pioneered fantasy in movies just like the books pioneered fantasy in books. And I'll be honest with you, Lord of the Rings pioneered it, but the Chronicles of Narnia kept that bar up. It came in the wake of Lord of the Rings, but in my personal opinion, I feel like it did just as good of a job at maintaining that momentum that the trilogy had established. I don't know. What do you think?
I think it does a lot of the things that Lord of the Rings does in the sense that it is a fantasy world that takes itself very seriously in all the right ways, not in a stoic way without any levity, but in the sense that it's written by, you know, one of the Inklings, you know, one of the classic Brit Lit authors that you probably learned about in English class in high school, C.S. Lewis, and they adapt his material very well. And so I will say, I think there's some crossover between Lord of the Rings and Narnia because they were familiar with each other, the two authors. And as a result, you can see the same with the movies. And there's just as much love. I mean, similar to the way that Tolkien's heirs were overseeing the Lord of the Rings movies, the same was with C.S. Lewis's heirs overseeing the making of these Narnia movies. And I do think, for a couple of reasons, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is the strongest one of the three that they did wind up making. And I think one of the reasons is, like you said, pacing. It really takes its time where it needs to, but then whenever it says, no, we got to keep moving, we're on a globetrotting quest, it doesn't hesitate. And there's some really cool themes. There's strong themes in all of these movies, but in this one particularly, we get to highlight those a lot. In the character development, in just the virtues of certain characters, there's some really cool things that we can learn about C.S. Lewis and what he was trying to convey. One last thing I will say, if I may touch on Tolkien and Lewis again, is a big difference between Tolkien and Lewis's work is in Lord of the Rings, it takes itself very seriously. It's a fantasy story, but it deliberately avoids allegory. Tolkien hates allegory. Notoriously, right. he says something along the lines of, I don't like allegory because it doesn't give the reader's imagination any opportunity within the snare of the writer's didactic motivations or something like that. You know, he's basically saying, I don't want to talk directly to my readers. I want my readers to find themes within my books. Lewis goes in the exact opposite direction. So if that's your sort of thing and you like allegory, then boy, oh boy, this movie is for you. It is rich with allegories, specifically within the Christian faith.
One of the topics that I love dabbling into is about the Inklings, which was it's fascinating to me as someone that loves the creative process. With this movie, I think it's really interesting how childlike it seems to be. And I'm not saying that is a bad thing. This is blissfully all in on its imagination. It's all in. You know, we have a, they didn't, this wasn't from the book, but I do think it helps. They added a sequence in World War II in the very beginning that kind of sets up the context for why these four kids have to leave their family and go to a stranger's mansion and stay there for a bit. So that's clever. I think that's a good addition. But once we get into Narnia, man, it just goes full force. And that's good in some ways, jarring in some others, which we'll touch on a little bit in our spoiler review. But James, wrapping this up, out of 5 stars, what would you give this installment?
I'm going to give The Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe a 3.5 out of 5.
Interesting. I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5. All right, let's zip on through the wardrobe and go into the White Witch's Hall of Spoilers.
Want to join the conversation? Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Casually Critical Podcast to get the inside scoop on future episodes. Feel free to message us on either platform to join in the casual correspondence or provide feedback on the show. Now it's time to dive into our spoiler review.
Okay, James. It's a little cold, a little freezing. There's ice and snow everywhere, but this is where the spoilers lie.
Here, Daniel, take this fur coat.
Oh, it's a girl's coat.
I know.
Okay. Well, girl's coat or not, I do feel a little bit more comfy, so I guess I can stay and we can talk spoilers a little bit. James, what stood out to you during this story? Watching this as a young adult man, a grown-up boy, an ancient fossil.
I am an ancient fossil. I think the biggest things that stood out to me were the effects and how they worked and how that really brought to life the world of Narnia. And really got me fighting for its cause because the characters are believable. The effects hardly ever took me out of the experience. So we had Mr. Tumnus with his goat legs, the replacement animation, all that jazz was very good. We had the beavers who, honestly, I thought looked pretty good. The most expressive and most the most screen time that an animated creature gets in this movie, I think they carry it very well. And they're some of my favorite fantasy side characters, to be honest. Because
really?
Yeah, I think that's another thing that stood out to me is that
it's like, how's my fur look, dearie?
Exactly. Yeah, like I don't know.
Typical Southern couple.
It's very different than your typical fantasy side characters. I think typically whenever we think of side characters in fantasy, we think of the magical animal companion. We think of the kind of the golem type, you know, the guide that's not entirely loyal. Those are some tropes, some archetypes that stand out. But the beavers, they are exemplars of hospitality. And that is something very near and dear to my heart. And I think they practice hospitality, welcoming them into their home, the Pevensey children, that is, and welcoming them to Narnia and demonstrating self-sacrificial love and protection as the Pevenseys kind of get acclimated and learn more about their role in Narnia. So that's one of the big things that stuck out to me.
It's interesting you brought up animal side characters because these beavers are the side characters in terms of the fact that they're not protagonists. The plot and the prophecy they talk about does not revolve around them.
Yeah.
But they are far from the side characters. They take charge in most of the scenes that they're in. Like, they're the ones leading the way. The Pevensey children are clueless. They have no choice but to follow them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a fun play on the dynamics, I think. I will say, and I don't know if there's a lot to talk about, but the big battle sequence at the end is by far the best PG-rated fantasy epic battle sequence. And it might just be the best ever battle sequence in a PG-rated movie I've ever seen. The staging, the cinematography in some shots, the music.
The music?
Oh my gosh. Like, that's one of the 7 wonders of the film music world, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Is the climactic Narnian battle sequence at the very end of this movie. Even in Prince Caspian, of which I have listened to the soundtrack again, the battle soundtrack in that movie does harken back to this OG masterpiece.
Can we dive a little bit deeper into that battle sequence? I feel like this is not something we get to talk about very often. What do you think made it so impressive? You've talked about several things about it that were good, the cinematography, the music, the staging, the lighting, all of that. What about those specific facets do you think made it stick out?
There's this word, flourish. When you're in swordplay, or maybe when you're an expert in cardistry, which is flipping of cards elegantly, there are these things called flourishes, which are basically gestures that aren't going to help you win a fight, but they might unsettle your opponent, or they're flashy is what they are. And in this battle, as they're setting the stage, as the writers are, as the whole filmmaking team is, there's a lot of flourishes that really help set the mood. One of them is we get this elegant aerial shot. I wouldn't be surprised if it was a helicopter shot of the Narnian army. There's a hippogriff, the first creature we see in this battle sequence, that flies down and he says, "Sire, they've outnumbered us vastly." I think the centaur who's there, who's one of my favorites and as a kid and still is, this dual-wielding swords guy.
Oh, so cool. Gosh, he gets some cool moments.
But then we get two shots of the White Witch's army. One is an aerial shot that slowly rises from the ground, so we get more of a vast view of the ground behind them. Because from the Narnian's perspective, it's just the White Witch and her little entourage on top of a little hill. But then as we pan, we don't pan, but we tilt down as the helicopter rises, we see a vast army. This was made with, I think, similar or the same technology that the Lord of the Rings VFX artists used in their battle sequences. Intelligent, AI-driven armies of creatures and characters. But then the White Witch tells her guys to attack, and there's this awesome, like, think of it this way. The White Witch's army and Aslan's army are similar. They're a hodgepodge of mythological creatures. Some of them are wild animals like rhinoceroses, cheetahs, whatever. And then there's also more abstract creatures like the minotaurs, the stairs, the fauns, whatever, goblins, giants.
Little werewolf dudes.
Little werewolf dudes. But think of how they present themselves. Another flourish. When the White Witch, well, her minotaur, the right-hand man, when he orders them to attack, they jump down from the hill. And it's that brutality, that kind of primal leaping and slamming onto the ground and charging that makes them feel more primal and more aggressive. Whereas the Narnians, they're gently riding down the steep incline of their hill to come and meet them. It's more elegant, but it's those small, simple things that really set the stage. The last thing I'll touch on before I turn it over to you, James, before we even clash, is the moment where they take this awesome music and they pull it out, and it's just quiet as the armies are about to collide, and then they do, and we get nothing but sound effect after sound effect. And this works in two ways. Number one, it's freaking awesome. Number two is it's intercut. As we are watching this battle, the battle is intercut with Aslan and the Pevensey girls, Lucy and Susan, crying over his body. And then, of course, he comes back and kicks butt in the end. But in that moment when the music goes away and we're just left with the sound of the
bang, bang, pew, 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 pew.
It's awesome. We cut to the Pevensey girls and with Aslan. And it's a very serious scene. How awkward would it have been if there's like this dun 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 dun, like this music, and then suddenly cuts to quiet and we're with Aslan. And it's like, oh, right, we have to be sad again. So subconsciously, them pulling the music away also prepares us for that sudden, very quiet scene as they're mourning the loss of this great lion.
That's great.
So that's what I've noticed, James. But how would you break down this battle sequence?
Breakdown is a good choice of words, because I think the first thing that comes to mind is that there are distinct phases to this battle that sort of break it down. There's the initial charge, like you said, the silence, you know, beforehand, and then just the wordless melee. And then you get the centaur archer launches the phoenix and there's a wall of fire. That's another section. And then the White Witch charges through that. And so another phase kind of kicks off from there where she starts turning people to stone. And that's where we start to see there's kind of the all is lost. It's very distinct. Whenever she starts turning people to stone, whenever she turns the hippogriff to stone and he smashes against the rocks and smashes the boulder bits fall onto his friends. We start to see maybe the tide of the battle going against Aslan's army. And then Aslan's kind of revitalized army comes from the White Witch's castle. And that kind of kicks off the third phase. So And even there, the terrain changes from one phase to the next. You know, the first phase is on the flat plains. The second phase is kind of on this more rocky terrain. And then the third phase is in this sort of canyon-like structure. It gets more and more rough. The terrain changes. Yeah. And so it's for that reason that it stands out to me as memorable, because it's not all in the same area. And there's different focal points to each part of the battle. Sort of like the Battle of Helm's Deep, there's always a different problem that is focused on in different parts of the Battle of Helm's Deep in Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers. And I think they follow in those footsteps very well here with the battle at the end of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
I think what's interesting is I'm looking at this from two mentalities. I'm looking at it from the mentality I had when I was a child watching this and just enjoying the pure awesome that so many of these scenes have had for me. But then I look at it from my more adult mindset, and I look at it from the context of our society today. We are in the midst of a movement in our generation where we like to rip things open and go, what's really there? You know, we look at war and we go, yeah, war is like action-packed, but there's a real cost. Let's explore that. Or, yeah, people act fine at work, but let's talk about mental illness. And at the risk of oversimplifying, which this most certainly is, I would say our generation loves depression. We like to find cynicism in every nook and cranny where it's like, but like, people die. That's heavy. Let's talk about that. And sometimes, honestly, I go, no, I don't want to. I want to enjoy something. But I feel weirdly about this movie, because while I enjoy it, and I don't think that everything should be deconstructed and questioned and talked about, like, for example, the fact that you were talking about there's this unquestionable good, the institution of Aslan is never once questioned, and that's fine. I like that. It's kind of refreshing, actually.
Yeah.
But where it gets weird for me is during the war scene, you have these four underqualified, poorly trained children thrust into leading an army, leading a battle. I guess maybe it's because it's PG, but it didn't feel like in some areas there were not as much teeth as there could have been. Pun intended, I guess. Do you feel the same way, or am I overthinking this?
No, I didn't really think about that a whole lot. There are a couple ideas that I had about the way children are presented in this movie that was refreshing, but I didn't really think about the teeth of it all.
Well, then, instead of me deconstructing, tell me about the way children were presented, because I remember you had quite a few things to say during our Sea Beast review.
Yeah, I think this runs parallel, and to catch you guys up, if you haven't listened to our Sea Beast review, which is totally fine, there's sort of this...
No, it's not. Binge casually critical.
They aren't that long. The episodes aren't that long. You can. There's this ongoing theme in children's media, especially in, you know, maybe 2010 and on, where the child is unquestionably the authority, is the one that we should be listening to. Why isn't anyone taking this kid seriously? Why don't we believe them? Why don't we listen to them more? They have a different point of view. That point of view is truly more enlightened because it's less bogged down by the weight of the world, which we get some of that. And it's mostly from a Christian worldview, which is one that I find to be more palatable because it's founded on something that I believe to be true, as opposed to, I don't know, humanism. But what we get balance in our child protagonists here. We see not only that children can have this wide-eyed wonder that can change people and change situations in a good way, but we also have the introduction of true selfishness that children can have. And that all people can have. Manifests mostly in Edmund, but also in the dynamic between Peter and Edmund, and then also some of Susan's cynicism, which is called out, even her skepticism. I really like that. We get a full, well-rounded picture of, you know, these human children characters, and that it's not all rosy, and it's their perspective is not perfect, because ultimately they're human. So I like that multidimensionality in our child characters.
And also kind of a sly commentary on the responsibility adult characters have. I mean, Lucy, which, by the way, quick shout out, Georgie Henley, who plays her, was, I believe, 10 years old or 9 years old when this movie came out, which means when they filmed it, she was probably 9 or 8. And she does amazing. I mean, for a child actor that young, mm-hmm. the range of emotion, the crying she does. You know, that scene with Aslan, I'm just thinking, okay, they probably made an actual dead lion, like, you know, kind of mannequin, and they said, hey, cry over this. She does, man. She does. And it's fantastic to watch. So I was blown away by that. But back to the commentary on adult responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Lucy walks into Narnia, and she just immediately trusts the first stranger she sees once he realizes he's not overtly trying to harm her, although later we learn he almost did and regrets it and decides to help her anyway. But she blindly trusts him, which is very characteristic of a child. But then Edmund comes along and does the same thing, but it's the wrong person.
Yep.
And it messes him up. And I just went, man, what a great play on celebrating childhood and also calling it and adulthood into criticism of, like, we need to be careful about this, you know? It's the influence yeah. that adult people can have on a child. And like you were saying, watching this post-2010s movement of children in movies being the figureheads, it's kind of sad in a way, because I feel it absolves adults of responsibility of saying, well, you're old now. You're not a child. You're part of the problem. So you're not as open. And that's not true. Children are innocent in a lot of ways, but they can also be foolish and they can also be young. And so we need to take into account the best of both worlds. And I think this does a great job at subtly calling that in to question without overtly saying it. I didn't even pick up on Susan's skepticism until further into the movie, especially when Mulgrim is confronting them on the melting river.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, we should listen to him and all this stuff to Peter. And I was like, I want to punch you. But then because I was like, this is not the time to, like, take a stand when you're about to die on by river or by fur. But I also get it, you know?
Yeah.
So there's some really good thematic stuff here.
And even there's this line, this little argument that Peter and Susan have near the end of the movie where Peter says, why are you always like this? And she says, I'm just trying to be realistic. And he's like, are you trying to be realistic or are you trying to sound smart? And I love that because I do think, Daniel, I do think that calls attention to what you were saying earlier about how we just have to pick everything apart. Just find the cynical angle in certain things and, you know, talk about corporate greed or talk about ulterior motives or talk about you know, yeah, what's their real motivation, though? And I think that's probably a line from the book, because that sounds just too rich to not be. And I can really imagine Lewis just calling out the skeptics that say and saying, hey, I know that it's okay to think about things a lot, but also, are you doing it for the right reasons, or are you just trying to sound more intelligent than everyone else? And I felt called out by that as a journalist.
Yeah.
I was like, shoot, you've got a good point. How many times do I spout off criticisms just to sound smart? Am I doing that right now?
I've seen that too in discussions I've had at the church I work at with people that are very hesitant. They take their skepticism, shield themselves with it, and call it intelligence. But when you think about it, it isn't intelligent, because anyone can question something. But there reaches a certain point where you got to trust, you got to take a step, and then let the fruit or results of that step determine if that was the right choice to make or not. Sometimes you just got to do it. Most of the time, if not all of the time, you got to do it. And being skeptical is useful, but very quickly it can turn into a stiff arm from yourself, from other people, and heaven forbid, yourself and the truth.
Yeah, it can become a huge sandbag, you know,
oh, yeah.
That weighs you down.
Goodness. Wrapping up, this is a classic movie I saw as a kid that we saw as children. And now, growing up, while this isn't the best movie I've ever seen, it is still, in my opinion, a very strong film. in a lot more surprising ways than I initially thought.
I agree. I think some of it is the nostalgia factor, Daniel. But I think the reason I gave it a 3.5 out of 5 instead of something stronger is because there are some slip-ups in there, and some of the acting isn't perfect. Some of the writing and the way that they handle Aslan's resurrection, I personally find to be a little sloppy. And I think it's kind of impossible to properly allegorize the Easter story. So it did just feel a little off to me. And I just wonder I wonder about viewers outside of Christian circles watching this movie and what they think. That's really what I want to know. But it still touched my heart, you know, even though it was not perfect. So you gotta give it that much. And shoot, there's a big frickin' rhinoceros that runs through and goes and smashes through. Yeah, and then there's big wolves that go, be careful, human. So cool.
And then Liam Neeson is a friggin' awesome lion.
Goodness. Oh my gosh, yeah. It comes from a rich source, and therefore it is a rich movie.
All right, well, we're Daniel and James, and you've been listening to our podcast.
Hey, Daniel, wait. I want to do the outro.
Do not cite the deep magic to me, witch. I was there when it was written. Goodbye.